How long can you stand on one foot without tipping over? Actually, let's give it a try. Wherever you are out there watching this, I invite you to stand where you are and assume the position. Now, if you have balance issues, you might not want to do this, but otherwise, how long do you think you could stand there on? I'll tell you, thinking about it is the worst thing that you can do. So maybe we should sit down before somebody gets hurt. Resume your seats, please. You may wonder, why did we do that? Actually, I'm not going to tell you until a little bit later in today's sermon. So just tuck that away. By the way, we apologize for the technical issues that we were having today, but we are, some of you switched from Facebook and YouTube to the church website. That's great. We are back up on Facebook and YouTube, and so if you prefer that venue, you can switch back over there now. And thank you for your patience with us. Let's start with a prayer. God, we come again to this moment hungry to learn from the Holy Scriptures and from Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior and our Master Teacher. Open our hearts to what Jesus wants to teach us today. We ask in His name. Amen. We, most of us, love asking and answering questions about the greatest thing in this or that category. For example, what is the greatest movie you've ever seen? All across the church website, Vimeo, Facebook, YouTube right now, feel free to nominate what you regard as the greatest movie you've ever seen. I, for one, would answer that question by saying, for me, Dead Poets Society, a movie where Robin Williams plays an eccentric professor who challenges his students to live fully and authentically. It's a powerful, challenging movie. Here's another one for you. What is the greatest song you ever heard? I would probably say Celine Dion singing "My Heart Will Go On" in the Titanic movie. Actually, I could sing it for you if you want. Or maybe not. Here's a third one. What is the greatest restaurant you've ever experienced? I would say the Meadowlark Inn, located in the countryside outside of Washington, D.C. It was close to where David and I used to live. It's in a renovated farmhouse, a white clapboard farmhouse. And the food there, what's the term they use on the food channel? It's a fusion. The food they serve there is what happens when city sophistication meets down-home cooking. It was an incredible. We'd go to it all the time back in the day. By the way, this Tuesday, David and I will be celebrating our 30th wedding anniversary. It is a miracle that anybody could put up with me that long. But in any event, Jesus Christ Himself was once asked one of those greatest questions. In His case, the question was, what is the greatest commandment? In Jesus' time and culture, it was becoming common for faithful people twice a day to recite a Jewish prayer known as the Shema. That prayer would begin with words quoted from Deuteronomy 6:5. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. So one day, when a lawyer asked Jesus, and by the way, lawyers in Jesus' culture were experts in the religious law, so they were more like what we today would call a theologian. So one day, when a lawyer slash theologian came to Jesus, he asked him, Matthew 22:36, "Teacher, which commandment in the law is the greatest?" And Jesus quoted from Deuteronomy 6:5, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the greatest and the first commandment." But that, of course, begs the obvious next question, which is, what does it look like for someone to love God with all their heart? Jesus anticipates and goes on and answers that question as well. Continuing in verse 39, he says, "And the second commandment is like the first." In other words, they're inextricably intertwined. And then Jesus quotes from Leviticus 19:18, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and prophets." In Jesus' eyes, these two commandments, love God with all your might, love your neighbor as yourself, are inextricably intertwined. You can't have one without the other. The key indicator of how much we love God is how well we love our neighbor. 1 John chapter 4, verse 20, "Those who say, 'I love God,' and hate their brothers or sisters are liars. For those who do not love a brother or sister whom they have seen cannot love God whom they've not seen. The commandment we have from Jesus is this: those who love God must love their brothers and sisters also." Which brings us back to where we started today. How long can you stand on one foot? Back in Jesus' time, there was a great Jewish rabbi, a great teacher, renowned rabbi named Hillel the Elder. Hillel died when Jesus was a teenager. So that means when Jesus and his family made their pilgrimages to the temple in Jerusalem, as a young boy with his keen interest in the temple and spirituality, Jesus likely had the opportunity to hear Hillel teach directly. And certainly Jesus would have known of Hillel and his great teachings, and apparently they had a real influence on Jesus because of the similarities. One day, an unbeliever came to Hillel and laid a challenge before him. He said, "I will convert if you can explain to me your faith while I'm standing on one foot." In other words, don't make it complicated. Don't make it convoluted. Give me the essence of your faith. Hillel accepted the challenge. And so the unbeliever assumes his posture, confident that this will be an impossibility for Hillel. Hillel simply smiles and quotes Leviticus 19:18, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." Leaving the unbeliever still standing there, dazed and amazed. And by the way, the unbeliever became a convert. Because you see, Hillel, like Jesus, understood that the single greatest indicator of how much we love God is how well we love our neighbor. Instinctively, we sense the truth of that. When we see it, somebody loving their neighbor, we instinctively recognize that God is among us, that God is powerfully present in the heart of that person. A little over a year ago, Alexa Bjorgson was about to put her young son Landon on a plane flight from Las Vegas to Portland to visit his father. She was very anxious because this was going to be Landon's first solo plane flight. On top of that, Landon is on the autism spectrum, and Alexa was worried that he would prove to be an annoyance to the passenger who would be in the seat next to him. So to anticipate that, to prepare for that, Alexa wrote out a note that she gave to Landon to hand to the person who sat in the seat next to him that explained that he was on the autism spectrum and to ask that person to be kind and kind of keep an eye on him. She included her cell phone number, and also she included a $10 bill as a thank you to whomever was sitting next to him. When the plane landed in Portland, Alexa received a text with a selfie photo from a man named Ben Pedraza and her son, standing together side by side smiling, and a note was attached to this text message that said, "I was Landon's seat neighbor for his flight to Portland. He did ask if we were there yet several times, but he was a great travel buddy. He's a great kid, and you're a lucky mom." Alexa was so relieved and so grateful. She ended up posting the story and the selfie and so forth on Facebook, and since then it's been shared more than 130,000 times. Because when we see it, we recognize it. The single greatest indicator of how much we love God is how well we love our neighbor. When we see someone who is loving their neighbor well, we know God is among us, that God is powerfully present in their heart. Love your neighbor as yourself. But of course, that also leads to another obvious question. A question that was asked of Jesus on a different occasion by, as best we can tell, a different lawyer. In Luke chapter 10, verse 36, you heard it read, Luke chapter 10, verse 29, you heard it read a little bit earlier. Another lawyer one day says to Jesus, "Who is my neighbor?" Back in olden times, people commonly made a distinction between their neighbors, people who were like them, people who were familiar to them, and others, those who were unlike them, those who were unfamiliar to them. One morning, little Johnny's brand new baby brother was screaming up a storm. Annoyed, Johnny said to his mom, "Where did we get him from?" Mom said, "He came from heaven, Johnny." Johnny said, "Wow, I can see why they threw him out." Who is it in your circle of neighbors or would-be neighbors that you would like to throw out? We are tribal creatures, right? As human beings, we are naturally tribal creatures. We gravitate toward those who are like us, those who are familiar to us, and we are quick to discard, dislike, or worse, those who are other. So, when this lawyer says to Jesus, "Who is my neighbor?" it prompts Jesus to tell his most famous parable ever, the parable of the Good Samaritan. You heard Duty reading it to us a little bit earlier today. Jesus tells about a man who was traveling on foot from Jerusalem to Jericho. And on the way, he is attacked by bandits. They beat him, they rob him, and they leave him half dead by the side of the road. Not long after that, a Jewish priest comes along and sees his fellow Jew dying beside the road, but the priest passes by. Just because you're religious doesn't mean your heart is full of God. Not long after that, a Levite comes by. Levites were volunteers who assisted the priests in the temple. So they were the ancient equivalent of a church volunteer, kind of like a Sunday school teacher or a deacon. So there's this Levite who's passing by this their fellow dying Jews see him there, and they're indifferent. They don't want to get involved. They pass by. Finally, there is a third person who passes by, and this is where the story takes a dramatic turn that would have shocked Jesus' Jewish listeners. A third person passes by who is dumb, da-dum, dumb, dumb, a Samaritan. What? Jesus' Jewish listeners would have been shocked because typically then Jews hated the Samaritans and vice versa. The ancestors of the Samaritans were Jews who had intermarried with Assyrians when several hundred years earlier the Assyrians invaded Israel, thereby creating a new ethnicity, a new culture, and a new approach to religion. Right in the heart of Israel. So that by the time of Jesus, if you were a Jew living in the north of Galilee and you wanted to travel to Jerusalem in the south, you would have to pass through Samaritan territory. They were different ethnically, culturally, religiously. The Jews hated them and they reciprocated. The audacity of Jesus to make the hero of his parable a Samaritan. The Samaritan sees the Jew dying by the side of the road and without hesitation administers first aid, then puts the Jew on his donkey and takes him to an inn. And out of his own pocket, the Samaritan pays the innkeeper to let this Jewish man stay there and recover for as long as it takes. And with that, Jesus turns to the lawyer slash theologian who had asked the question, who is my neighbor? And says to him in verse 36, which of these three, the priest, the Levite, or the Samaritan, was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? Well, the Samaritan. Exactly. Jesus then says, go and do likewise. The point being, my neighbor is everybody, especially those who are different from me. Authentic followers of Jesus do not have cramped definitions of neighbor. And so we who would follow Jesus have to ask, what does it look like to love those who are different from me? Answer, do what the good Samaritan did. Dare to make contact with the one who is other. Dare to get to know them. Dare to open your heart and listen to them deeply. A wise person once said, listening is so close to loving that we feel loved when we're listened to. That's why I'm so excited about reading Ibram Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. As you know, as you heard Pastor Vivian say a little bit earlier in the service, in a couple weeks, in the middle of September, a number of our Oasis groups are going to be walking through that book together in four deep conversations. By the way, by next Sunday, we will give you a list of the Oasis groups that will be offering this for others who want to participate. But I've begun reading Kendi's book, and I'm excited because I see it as an opportunity to practice deep listening. As a white person, I can never fully or even partially understand the experience of a person of color unless I am prepared to listen deeply to the experiences, the life experiences, the perspectives of my brother and sisters of color.
already in the introduction to Kendi's book. I'm starting to see things in ways it never would have occurred to me to see them before. For example, in his introduction, Kendi talks about that statement that those of us who are white often have learned to make. The statement goes like this: I'm colorblind, I don't see race. And when we say that, it's because we've been taught to say that. We think we're saying something noble. But in his introduction, Kendi points out that that statement rings very different in the ears of a person of color. To a person of color, when a white person thinks, I'm making a noble statement, I'm colorblind, I don't see race, a person of color is hearing dismissiveness. We've had 400 plus years in America where we did see race in very adverse ways. And so to say, well, I don't see race, sounds dismissive of the impact of 400 years of cultural conditioning and the reality of how much it profoundly affects all of us who are white. Just this week on the news, I heard a new study that was released, a 3-decades-long study of infant mortality among black children. The study surprisingly discovered and documented that a black infant who is cared for by a white doctor is twice as likely to die in the first year of life than a black child who is cared for by a black doctor. Whoa. Now, the point of the study was not that white doctors would intentionally provide less care to a black child. There are all kinds of complicated dynamics going on there. Cultural differences. Differences in communication styles. Trust differences. And something called implicit bias. If you are white like me and you don't think you have implicit bias. Implicit bias means subconscious bias. In other words, I can be consciously with all of my heart thinking, I will not treat people differently based on color. And still subconsciously, in subtle but powerful ways, without realizing it, I can be doing that. And if you don't believe it, go online and take one of these implicit bias tests. It's amazing what the subconscious brain can do to us without us even realizing it. And so, when we who are white say, I don't see color, I'm colorblind, I don't see race, to the ear of a person of color, it sounds dismissive. It sounds like we're saying, you know, this isn't a big problem. We're over this. It sounds to a person of color like we're saying, I'm neutral. I'm not part of the problem. But it's not enough, as followers of Jesus, being good neighbors to not be a part of the problem. We need to be a part of the solution to the problem. So Kendi challenges this not just to be neutral, which allows the status quo to continue, but to be actively pushing back against racism. And that means, in the opposite way, we do have to see color and how color still affects people's experiences in our country. I never would have thought of it that way if I wasn't willing to listen to and be stretched by the experience of my brothers and sisters of color. Half the battle for being a good neighbor is becoming a good listener. And by the way, what is true at the macro level of broad cultural issues like racism is also true at the micro level right at home where we live. Let me explain what I mean by that. For those of us who are married, I have a news flash for you today. Now, this will be shocking to you, but here's the news flash. Your spouse is different from you. And that means your spouse will constantly be doing things that you do not understand. Your spouse will constantly be doing things in a way that you would not do it. The stranger in your household. Some of us have read that classic book by Gary Chapman called The Five Love Languages. The basic premise of the book is that through a combination of nurture and nature, we learn how to speak and receive, how to share and receive love. Different ways of sharing and receiving love that he calls love languages. The odds that you and your spouse speak the same love language intuitively is slim. And so, let's say if your primary love language is physical touch, you will feel really loved when you and your spouse spend an evening snuggling on the couch watching television. Meanwhile, if your spouse's primary love language is deeds of service, your spouse is probably laying there on the couch snuggling with you thinking, enough snuggling already, when are you going to get up and fix me a sandwich? Because that's what makes them feel loved. They probably grew up in a family where the way your love was expressed is what you do for somebody. And you probably grew up in a family where the way you express love is through physical touch, hugging, kissing, sitting close, holding hands, expressions of affection. If we do not realize how different we are, and therefore how important it is that we be listening deeply to each other, there's no hope. We can end up being strangers sharing the same space. How ironic it would be if the person that I most need to be a better neighbor to is the one who's closest to me. Ouch. This past week, speaking of great Robin Williams movies, this past week, Pastor Vivian, in one of her Be Still and Know daily devotionals, reminded us of William's role in Mrs. Doubtfire. You know the story, right? That the character played by Robin Williams, Daniel, gets a divorce from his wife, Miranda, and it's a bitter divorce, and she ends up with sole custody over his kids, which means he can't see them. He's desperate to see his kids, and so out of his desperation, he takes on an alternative persona. He dresses himself up, makes himself up as an elderly nanny named Eugenia, I think that was her name, Eugenia Doubtfire, something like that, right? And gets hired by Miranda as the nanny to care for their kids during the day while she's away at work. And oddly enough, Mrs. Doubtfire and Miranda get along really well. One day they're having a heart-to-heart conversation where Miranda is sharing what went wrong in her marriage, thinking she's speaking to Miss Doubtfire, not realizing she's speaking this directly to her husband, Daniel. And she says, "I was working all the time, and he was always between jobs. I hardly ever got to see the kids. And on nights I tried to get home early to be with them, something would go wrong. The house would always be wrecked, and I'd have to clean it up. He never knew, but so many nights, I just cried myself to sleep." Mrs. Doubtfire, crushed, says, "Really?" Miranda says, "Truth is, I didn't like who I was when I was with him. I'd turn into this horrible person. I didn't want my kids growing up with a mother like that. When I'm not with him, I'm better. And I'm sure he's better when he's not with me." Mrs. Doubtfire, fighting back tears, "Well, you never, I mean, did you ever say anything to him, dear?" "No." And then Pastor Vivian asked us, "Why is it that it's so hard for us to have honest conversations with those who are closest to us?" Jesus once said in Matthew 25:25, "I was a stranger and you welcomed me." What if the person who most needs me to be a better neighbor is not someone living next door? Not someone living across town, Not the stranger in the street, but the person that's closest to me. I saw a meme that's been going around the internet lately that says, the internet went down and I had to spend time with the family. They seem like good people. Let me make a suggestion. I invite all of us who are willing to participate in an exercise this week, a homework exercise that flows out of what Jesus is teaching in today's scriptures. Let's call it a deep listening exercise. For those of us who are married, let's do this with our spouse. Set aside an hour and have this conversation. For those of us who are single, invite someone who's close to you to participate in this conversation with you. We were speaking earlier about questions about the greatest this or that. Going off of that theme, here are three suggested questions. And by the way, you'll find these questions printed in the brief narrative intro to this sermon that you'll find when the sermon is posted a little bit after worship on each of the three platforms that we broadcast on. Also, if you're in one of our Oasis groups, they'll be attached to the Oasis discussion questions. But here are the three deep listening exercise questions. At this point in your life, what is your greatest aspiration? Number two, at this point in your life, what is your greatest fear? And number three, at this point in your life, what is one of your greatest memories of our time together? You may think you know me, but maybe you don't. Because we're so different, and we're constantly changing and evolving. That's why we have to keep communicating. That's why we have to keep listening deeply. Not just to the stranger across town, but to the strangers in our own household. Half the battle in being a good neighbor is learning to listen deeply. I saw a photograph of a chalkboard sign outside of a coffee shop that reads like this: no Wi-Fi. Talk to each other. Call your mom. Pretend it's 1993. Live. I want us to take with us today that loving your neighbor is definitely about people far away, but it's just as much about people who are right next to us. But before we close, allow me to pose one last question, and this may be the most difficult question of all. Suppose Jesus told his parable differently. Suppose in Jesus' parable, the Good Samaritan came along while the attack by the bandits was in process. In that scenario, what should the Good Samaritan do? Just let it happen? Or pull a knife and counterattack? In other words, if everybody's my neighbor, including the person who causes harm to others, if I love both the victim and the victimizer, what does that look like? Thankfully, from the life of Jesus, we have a couple examples that I think can point us in the right direction. There was that time when Jesus got so fed up with how spiritual leaders, Pharisees, were spiritually victimizing the common people that he called them out. I mean, he laid it out. He called them scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, and he publicly laid out the indictment against them. There was another time when Jesus was so fed up with priests not allowing room in the temple where they were supposed to for common people to come and pray that Jesus launched a protest in the temple, even overturning money tables. Because he loved the people who were being hurt, and because he loved the people who were doing the hurting, loving somebody does not mean enabling them. Loving somebody means you care enough to do what's best for them, and stopping or doing your best to stop someone who's doing others harm is love. But in situations like this, it is so easy to act out of the wrong motive. And so when we find ourselves in a situation like that, it's imperative that we step back and ask, am I being motivated right now by hate for my enemy? Or by love for my enemy and the victims of my enemy? If we're acting out of love, doing the best we can, then we're doing the right thing. But even if I'm doing a good thing out of hate, that's not going to go well. Because our goal is not just to save the victim. It is that, first and foremost. It is secondarily to redeem the enemy. Let me close with a powerful example of that principle at work. Saint Nicholas, the historical figure, Saint Nicholas, that ultimately gave rise to the legendary Saint Nick, but the actual historical Saint Nicholas lived about 300 years after the time of Christ. He became the bishop of Myra in a province located in what would be modern-day Turkey. When the bishop, Saint Nicholas, was 70 years old, the governor of that province was becoming increasingly more and more corrupt. One day it came to the attention of Saint Nicholas that the governor had sentenced 3 innocent people to death without the benefit of trial. Incensed, Saint Nicholas, though he was 70 years old, broke out into a dead run to the plaza where the executions were to take place. When he arrived, already the 3 condemned men were on their knees, hoods over their heads, hands tied behind their backs. They were as good as dead. Nicholas, shouting, pushed his way through the crowd to the front, ripped the sword out of the executioner's hand, threw it to the ground. The executioner, fearful of the bishop's spiritual power and fearful of the bishop's God, deferred. Saint Nicholas, with dramatic flair, untied the innocent men and set them free, and then turned and marched to the governor's palace. 70 years old, he broke down the door and ordered the sentinels to summon the governor. The governor, fearful of the bishop's spiritual power and fearful of the bishop's God, walks into the room deferentially and immediately begins paying compliments to Saint Nicholas, who cuts him off mid-sentence. Calls him a thief, an enemy of God. He calls him a sacrilegious God hater. And then he says this, "You dare to come before me, you who do not fear God, you who had the cruel intention to kill innocent people. Since you committed this wickedness, I cannot have any respect for you. God is reserving punishment for the unjust. God knows how your government works and how this province allows looting and killing of people against the law and without trial for deadly greed and gain." At which point, the governor falls to his knees, pleads forgiveness, and promises to do better. Saint Nicholas prays a long prayer over the governor and then pardons him. What a powerful example of what it looks like to love both the victim and the victimizer. When we find ourselves in those scenarios, in our family or in broader culture, it is imperative that we ask, am I acting out of a heart of love or a heart of hate? What does it look like to be a follower of Jesus? I can tell you, while standing on one foot, it means love God so much that you love your neighbor as yourself. If we could just live that, it would change everything. To whom do you right now in your life most need to be a better neighbor.